Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And boy, I am honored to speak with, finally, Zazie Todd. She's hot. She is the author now of these pet books that are doing very well and for good reason. This one is called Bark, The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. Good morning, Zazie. It's so nice to finally get to talk with you.
Good morning. I'm thrilled to chat with you at last.
Well, the same. And the first question I have, and I'm looking for the exact wording here in your book, is that you were walking down a dark alley or something, home from a nightclub with a friend, and you realized that the man that was staring at you inside the club is now following you down the street. You also write in that same paragraph about an angry mama bear that escorted you and your husband and your two dogs at the time down a mountain, huffing and puffing. And then you go on to talk about fear and anxiety and how these experiences caused fear and anxiety. Well, that's understandable, and the book is about dogs with fear and anxiety, and I promise to get there. But here's my question. You never explained what happened. The guy was following you home. You never said what happened. Did the bear eat you? I mean, you never explained all this, so... Hopefully, I mean, you're clearly okay.
Yes. So, yeah, those were two examples of times in my life when I have actually been absolutely terrified. And I included them in the book to make the point that fear actually can be a very useful emotion because it helps us when something dangerous happens. It helps us to take action that will help to keep us safe. So it's not that fear is always a bad thing. Sometimes it's actually a really useful thing, and we have to remember that because that applies to our dogs too. But for those particular stories, yes, so when I was young, I'd been at a nightclub, and a man was actually thrown out by the bouncers for harassing me, and it was several hours later when my friend and I were walking home, and we realized that he was following us down the road, and that was very, very scary. Luckily, he was a little bit behind us, and we were saved by the police, actually. A police car pulled up, said, "Is that guy troubling you?" And gave us a ride home. So we were safe.
All right, so I'm going to stop you there because I want to use that example. So let's talk about fear in dogs as well. So you could have done a couple of different things. Turns out the police picked you up. However, you could have run. You could have turned around and faced your fears, so to speak, and confronted this person, or you could have frozen in fright, actually. You could have been so afraid that you literally would have frozen up. Are those three options the same three options that dogs have? And if so, explain that these things just naturally, I mean, it's not that the dog thinks about what am I going to do in the same way that a person might.
Yeah, so we often talk about fight or flight. So in these moments, those are the most likely things for us to do. So we or our dogs don't necessarily even think about it. It might be very automatic that we're going to either fight or run away. And so for dogs, very often they actually will want to run away from something they're afraid of, and they're not always able to because very often we have them on a leash so they can't. But I think it's really helpful for people to remember that we're all mammals, so, you know, our dogs and us share a lot of evolutionary history, and so they too have developed these emotions and respond in very similar ways to us. And so sometimes it can help us be more empathic towards our dogs when they're fearful if we think about what it's like for us when we're afraid of things, because we all have things that we're afraid of. Everyone has something that they are afraid of, and often we have things that aren't really reasonable to everyone else, so maybe being afraid of spiders or something like that. And that can help us to understand that to protect dogs, we don't, like, we would not like it if someone just dropped a spider on our head or something. We don't do things like that with our dogs either. We need to help them to be safe from the things that they're afraid of.
And you talk about being safe a lot, and I want to talk about that, but let's talk about the dogs that you write about. It's a lot of dogs, and when we're walking down the street and a dog is approaching us and you're walking, say, with a dog, and that dog approaching us goes either at you or your dog or both, you explained that generally speaking, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, dogs that we call aggressive are actually fearful. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so very often in these situations, actually the dog is really struggling. The dog is finding things really difficult. And so when they growl, for example, or they lunge on the leash, usually, not always, but usually they're trying to say, get away from me, I don't feel comfortable. And that they're trying to increase the distance between them and the person or the dog that they don't want to come near. So we can think of that growling as a really useful signal that's telling us that the dog is feeling uncomfortable. And that's why we should never, ever punish a dog for growling, because it's really important information. This is their way to communicate to us that they're unhappy, and that lets us step in and do something about it.
Oh, that's so important. So I wanted to ask you about it, but I will right now. So we tend, because sometimes dog trainers have told us to do this, or sometimes, frankly, it's because we have a problem. We're human. And the dog goes, and we tend to want to punish that, or at least make that, am I doing that well? Sound, I don't think I am. Go away. But you explain that by doing that, then at least one signal, hopefully there are others, but at least one signal to identify what your dog is feeling. If that goes away, that signal goes away. Why is that a bad thing?
That can be a really unfortunate thing, because that signal is the dog saying they're uncomfortable. And if they can't say that, or they don't feel they can say that because we punish them for growling, the risk is that they're then going to go to a bite. I mean, there might be steps in between. They might go to an air snap or something like that. But the risk is that they might bite. And this is one of those times when people often say, well, the dog, they bit out of the blue. They weren't expecting them to bite. And so people can be quite shocked to get bitten then. But it's because the dog no longer has a way of telling you that they feel uncomfortable. That's kind of a nicer, more easy way for them to say it. So they've had to escalate things to get you to pay attention. And it's really unfortunate when that happens. And we want to do everything we can for the sake of the dog and the person to avoid situations in which someone is going to get bitten.
Oh, there's a lot there I want to ask about. Essentially, then, what do we do about dogs that are aggressive? And why are we seeing more fears and anxiety? As you write, we are seeing more since the pandemic. And I love the part, bullet point by bullet point, where you write facts about fearful dogs. And really what these are not facts, but the reverse. They are myths about fearful dogs, and you debunk them one by one by one by one. And we're going to do the same when we come back with Zazie Todd, the author of Bark, The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. We will do that on WGN next. Zazie Todd, that's her name, and she is the author of Bark. I hope I'm doing that right. I'll try it again. Bark. Maybe yeah. That's better. I'm doing it right. The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. You write in the book that dog fears and anxieties have worsened since the pandemic. And I'm wondering why you think that is the case.
This is one of those things that lots of people think have happened, and these days we actually have some scientific research on it as well to confirm that it's not just an impression. Actually, it does seem to be the case, even if we don't have full population studies that we would like, but there is some research on it. So one of the things that happened is during the pandemic, a whole lot of people rushed out to get dogs, and a lot more people than usual. If anyone was trying to get a dog then, like me, it was really hard to do. And so it also was very difficult for people who got a puppy to actually socialize the puppy. And we know that one of the most important things you can do to prevent fears and anxieties is to socialize your puppy between 3 and about 12 to 14 weeks. And that wasn't always possible. Or if it was possible, people didn't actually feel safe doing it because, understandably, they didn't want to risk getting COVID. So a whole lot of dogs didn't get that socialization. And then on top of that, there's a couple of other things as well. So it turns out that many of the people who were getting dogs then were getting them for the first time, and they didn't do as much research as we would like them to do. So they didn't necessarily see the pup with the mom, which again is understandable. At that time, it was quite difficult. But ideally, if you're getting a puppy, you want to know that you have seen them with the mom, or you have, if you're a long distance away, you have seen really clear video that you know for sure that this puppy is being raised in a good home environment where socialization is already happening at the breeder.
You know, one concern I have, and we're getting off the topic a little bit, but not, is where people get dogs from in the first place, particularly puppies. So on the way here to the radio station this morning, I saw a mini Bernedoodle. I didn't know there were mini Bernedoodles. Now, this dog, this little puppy, seemed happy and healthy. But my concern is that they're not all, especially the so-called designer breeds. And I don't know about, you're in Canada, so it may not be the same, but I wonder if that plays into it as well. More people buying the so-called designer dogs without doing proper homework, definitely without seeing where the dogs are from in the first place, not visiting where that dog is from. Maybe the dogs are driven to them. Maybe they're flown to them. So we're really not understanding, not seeing how these dogs are raised in the first place. Is that an issue?
It is really important to know where a puppy is coming from, because unfortunately a lot of puppies are raised in what we'd call puppy mills.
Yeah.
Or puppy farms, and that means that they're raised basically in like a battery farm like setting, and they are not in a home. They need to be raised in a home environment because that's where they're going to be living and spending their lives, and so that's really important for their behavioral development. And they need to be raised in an environment that's an enriched environment where they have space to play with the other puppies and get to hang out with their mom and get experience to household noises, like, and get to see people coming into the home. So there is already lots of socialization happening then. And if they don't come from that environment, then that means that when they come to you, unfortunately, they're already at increased risk of developing behavior issues.
Absolutely. All right. Speaking of behavior, you write about myths and outdated information about fearful dogs. And I want to take these one by one. So what we have read in some places at some point in time, that by comforting a dog that is, say, terrified of fireworks or thunderstorms, or is expressing aggression toward another person or another dog, we're making matters worse. Are we really?
It's one of those myths. The thing is, actually, your job as your dog's guardian is to comfort them when they're afraid, if they would like to be comforted. Now, it's important to know they might not actually want that, but basically, the research on dogs shows that you are what we call, a technical term, a secure base for them. And basically, as your dog's guardian, your presence can help them to feel more comfortable and less stressed. And we know that if they see something that's stressful, very often they will look to their guardian to see, you know, is this okay, or is this something that I should be worried about? And so it's really important for you to be there for your dog, to protect them from whatever they are afraid of, and to comfort them if they would like it.
All right. Now, the next one is about dominance. And, you know, as well as I know, there seems to be a resurgence of dog trainers. So we were going in the right direction, Zazie, at some point in time. But now there seem to be more and more dog trainers, particularly those on TikTok or Instagram, that are talking about being dominant over your dog. Sometimes they say, well, look at wolves as an example. They have a pack leader. You need to be that pack leader the same way as wolves have a pack leader. That's not at all true, is it?
That's not how it is, no. And I think we are still going in the right direction, but unfortunately some things get amplified a lot on social media and that are quite harmful for dogs. So what we actually know about wolves is that they're families and they're very cooperative as a species. And so a lot of the behaviors that we see in wolves are actually about cooperating. It's not at all about the pack leader, basically, is the parent. And that's a much better metaphor for how we think about dogs. Of course, dogs are not wolves, but it's a much more nurturing kind of way of thinking about the dog in our home. And it's much better because, unfortunately, very often these people who talk about dominance in dogs are also likely to use aversive training methods, which are not good for the dog.
And in fact, wolf packs don't operate that way anyway. It's not the strongest that is demonstrating the most dominance. It's the mother or grandmother or great-grandmother in some cases, and it's a family. And just because she is a she and because she is the oldest, she is the so-called leader. But it doesn't work the way that some dog trainers suggest it works in wolves anyway. They've got that wrong, and they definitely have that wrong because wolves are not dogs, and dogs are not wolves. What about the notion that if your dog is afraid of something, anything, the best thing to do is to have the dog face its fears? So if the dog is afraid of, I don't know, say, shopping carts, you know, they make a loud clanging sound. Why I came up with that, actually, I don't know for sure, but I did. So let's say it's shopping carts. So the best thing you can do then is to hold your dog down right near where they're shopping. Take your dog to a grocery store. I don't know if you call them that in Canada. And hold your dog down right there and have your dog be right at those shopping carts. Is that the right thing to do?
Unfortunately, that is really terrible advice, which risks making things much, much worse. And what we need to do is to help make sure that the dog feels safe all of the time. So we are going to avoid having our dog anywhere close to a shopping cart where they start to feel worried. And when we want to work on it, actually, we're going to keep at a really nice distance where the dog can see the shopping cart, like right at the other end of the parking lot or something. That far away, they feel okay with it. And then we're going to give them some really wonderful treats, like pieces of steak or cheese or chicken or something like that, to help them to learn that actually the shopping cart is okay. And you should love the shopping cart, because when you see it every single time that you see it, we're going to give you all this wonderful steak and throw a party.
And you explain that in great detail in your book, Bark! The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. You're talking about desensitization and counterconditioning. We'll talk about that. And equipment to use, or better put, not to use when training a dog. And we'll do that when we come back on WGN. Our newsroom somehow missed this one. A Pakistani pigeon was arrested by Indian law enforcement on suspicion of being a spy. The bird flew over the contentious border and was apprehended due to a suspicious ring around its ankle printed with numbers. Eventually, it was found those digits were actually just the cell phone number of the pigeon's owner. After a thorough investigation, the pigeon was deemed not a threat to national security and was set free. It was just an innocent bird, officials said. But before you laugh it off, you should know that this wasn't the first case of avian espionage. In 2016, a pigeon was taken into Indian custody after it was found with a note threatening the Indian Prime Minister at that time. And that bird was taken seriously. All I know, it sounds like an episode from Get Smart, doesn't it? Zazie Todd is here, and she is the author of, well, lots of books, including Bark! The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. If you don't know Zazie Todd, she is a PhD in psychology and an honors graduate of the Academy for Dog Trainers and an affiliate member of the American Veterinary Society of Animal Behavior, and much more than that. Lots and lots of accolades for you. And one of the reasons why you have those accolades, I think, is that you have stood up against those who say it's okay. And this is, you know, I mean, maybe you're seeing it differently, but sadly, I'm seeing a growing number of trainers that are saying it's acceptable. In fact, I endorse using equipment like shock collars or those the cartoon dog looking prong collars, they're called, or chain link choke collars that I thought went out years ago. And in an effort to say, because right now in America, and I think in Canada, anyone can say, I'm a dog trainer. And there's no certification required. So all of these organizations got together that said, okay, we want to find a way in the United States to certify dog trainers. And the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers took the lead on this, which I think if the sentence stopped right there would be great. I think that's helpful. However, they've also said that, okay, we're going to this rule makes you a dog trainer, understanding learning theory, understand. And one other thing, you can use any kind of equipment, including shock collars and those prong collars I spoke about, or choke collars. Is it okay, Zazie? And are you actually potentially causing problems by doing so?
It is not okay to use aversive methods like shock and prong collars with dogs, or leash corrections as people call them, because there is a whole ton of research that shows that there are risks to using those methods, and those risks are increased fear, anxiety, aggression. It's a risk of the dog being more pessimistic, and it's a risk of a worse relationship between the dog and their guardian. And we all get dogs because we love them, so the last thing we want to do is kind of affect that relationship that we have with them. Because of all of this research, most of the professional dog training organizations, veterinary organizations, all have strong position statements saying that we should be using reward-based methods to train dogs. So, for example, the American Veterinary Society of Animal Behavior has a really great position statement saying that we should use reward-based methods to train dogs, and there are no circumstances in which people should be using aversive methods. So, as you say, anyone can call themselves a dog trainer. There is no certification. And so that means for dog guardians, they have to look really carefully to make sure that they get a dog trainer who is only going to use reward-based methods, because that is what is best for dogs.
And I want to be clear, when the Certification Council for Professional Dog Trainers said it will be okay when we certify dog trainers that they could use any kind of method, that all of these other organizations, Karen Pryor Academy for Dog Training, the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, the Academy for Dog Training and Behavior from Victoria Stilwell, Gene Donaldson's Academy for Dog Trainers, I'm doing this off the top of my head, the Pet Professional Guild, Association for Professional Dog Training International, and probably others that were on board have all said no and have issued statements like you describe, as the American Veterinary Society of Animal Behavior did, and say, no, we're not a part of that anymore. And I bring it up in reference, and you write about it in your book, Bark, because you're talking in the book about helping anxious, fearful, or reactive dogs. And many dog trainers say, all right, this is it. The dog has threatened to bite. Maybe the dog has already bitten someone or another dog. And this is your last effort. I am going to save your dog by using a choke collar. Or I meant to say choke collar. Yes, they may say that. What I meant to say, though, was shock collar, an e-collar. Do these types of equipment actually save dogs?
The thing is that if a dog is having behavior issues because they are fearful or anxious, punishing that behavior might make the behavior go away, perhaps temporarily, but it's not doing anything at all to address the dog's underlying issues of fear and anxiety. And it's really important to do that using techniques that we know work, and which are very, very effective, and which are kind and humane for the dog. So I'm talking about desensitization and counter conditioning, perhaps in conjunction with medications from your veterinarian, if that's appropriate. And we also have to recognize that sometimes these behavior issues have a medical or pain component underlying them. And again, it's really important then that the dog should see a vet and have that dealt with. And if instead you're just putting a shock collar on the dog to stop them from growling or lunging or whatever, and not dealing with any of these underlying issues, that's actually not good for the dog at all. And that's why all of these organizations have such strong position statements. And they've updated them over the years, and they've actually tightened them up over the years. And I'd just like to add one organization to your list, if that's okay, and that's the Canadian Association of Professional Dog Trainers as well. Given that I'm in Canada, within the last few years, they updated theirs as well. And I think there is this big movement to change there, which is really good for dogs.
This is one of the many reasons, hockey is another, why I love Canada. And you're also nice on top of everything else. So, and I do love Canada, by the way. So here's the thing. We left off something else. A shock collar can inhibit for a time, and you mentioned that, the behavior we don't want to see, but it doesn't give any information, zero, to the dog about what you do want the dog to do instead.
That's absolutely right, and it's really important for dogs that we give them clear guidance, that they know what to do, and we positively reinforce them for doing those things as well. Otherwise, it's horribly confusing for dogs. And the other risk is that they might learn to associate the shock on the collar with us. And so from an animal welfare perspective, if we look at models of animal welfare, they say that not just being with someone who is using aversive methods like a shock collar is bad for the dog, but also the dog has a memory. So even being in the presence of someone who has used such methods in the past is potentially bad for the dog's welfare, because they will remember that when they were with you, they got this shock, and they don't know necessarily the lesson you're expecting them to get. They just know it happened when you were there. So, and the other thing that I find really interesting is there was some research out of France which suggested that people who were using shock collars were not actually particularly happy with the results that they got from that study. So I found that quite interesting as well, that they weren't really, it didn't seem to be producing results that people were hoping. And some of the research, we need more research on it, but some of the research actually suggests that reward-based methods seem to be working better. One potential reason for that is that the dog is very motivated. Typically, we're using food, so you know dogs are really motivated by food. So that can help to encourage them to do the things that we want them to do.
And I want to talk more about encouraging the things you want the dog to do and how to deal with helping those anxious, fearful, or reactive dogs. We've touched on it a little bit. I want to talk in more detail about not only what not to do, but what to do. The name of the book is called Bark! Zazie Tide is the author. We'll be right back on WGN. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN Radio with Zazie Tide, the author of Bark! Or maybe I should do that again. Ruff! Is that better? The science of helping your anxious, fearful, or reactive dog. All right. So you write in the book, the training of a fearful dog involves working with what we call working under the threshold. And that's kind of the secret to taking a step in the right direction. And I said a step because people do want, I think, Zazie, these instant soup kind of results. And well, psychopharmaceuticals, as you mentioned, for a dog that's truly aggressive may be really important to help kind of reset the brain chemistry in that dog. It's impossible for dogs to learn when they are so fearful that they're terrified or panicked. So this helps to change that. But then the behavior modification is what becomes so important. Talk about what you mean working under the threshold. And I think you're going to again describe desensitization and counterconditioning.
Absolutely. So it's really important to make sure that your dog feels safe all of the time, including in your training. And sometimes people ask me how much training can they do with a fearful dog, because they worry that they're subjecting the dog to something they're afraid of. They should not be subjected to anything. They should be happy, cheerful, enjoying the training, looking for the treats. And what you want to make sure is that every single time the thing that they consider scary happens, you give them that ultimate snack, whatever that is for your dog, whether it's steak or cheese or chicken or whatever, and you throw a really big party so they have this wonderful, lovely surprise of something unanticipated, and it over time is going to teach them that they actually love this thing that they previously considered scary.
Is timing important, though, for this, or having a professional on board? So let's say you're walking down the street, your dog does not like other dogs, and your dog begins to lunge, and you give your dog a piece of chicken. Now, if your dog is that terrified, upset, whatever the right word might be, panicked, your dog may not take that piece of chicken or whatever the treat is. However, even if your dog does, the question I have is you also don't want to reinforce with that chicken your dog taking that kind of action. You may not be able to reinforce the emotion, but you may be able to reinforce what the dog is actually doing. Do you follow that question?
That's a really great question, and I think it's one that people often have because they worry about reinforcing the dog's lunging. It's not going to happen, but ideally you want to avoid getting in that situation where the dog is going to be lunging and barking. So you might need to keep your eyes open for other dogs coming and be ready to cross the street. You might need to teach your dog a turn and go beforehand so that when you spot a dog in the distance, you can turn and go away from it. And it really also helps to do setups, which is easiest to do with a dog trainer, where you can have someone else or someone else and their dog at a safe distance that you can use for training so that you know you've got that distance where your dog is not lunging and barking. Now, there are times when it all goes wrong, and unfortunately that happens, and we can see that as a learning experience, but in the moment we can try to get our dog out of that and still offer the food, because the thing is you're trying to change how your dog feels about the situation. So get them out of there so they're not lunging and barking. Still offer the food even if they won't take it. And I've got a story in Bark of how that actually can still work, even
Indeed.
Though you're trying yep. to keep your dog feel safe all the time.
Yeah, and you also talk about dogs that are less maybe motivated by food. You also have a list of aversive or punishment-based training methods, and it's kind of a long list. I'm not going to go through this entire list. But should, in your world, each and every one of these bullet points you have, should they be eliminated from the planet? And we would then have an easier time training dogs or reconditioning dogs who require that.
Yes, it would be much better for dogs if more people only used reward-based methods. And the good news and where we are making progress is that most dog guardians do use positive reinforcement to train their dog. The unfortunate part is that not everyone sticks to positive reinforcement all of the time, and that's where we need to make improvements. I put the list in the book with a warning for people because, you know, if you don't use these methods and you're not used to seeing them, actually it's a shock that people want to do these things to dogs. But unfortunately, some of the trainers who use these methods, they kind of use euphemisms to describe them, or they make it not really quite clear what they're doing. And I think that's because they know that people want to be using positive reinforcement with their dog. And it's not regulated. Anyone can call themselves a dog trainer. So you have to be really, really careful in hiring a dog trainer and making sure that you're not using these tools. And because it's not regulated, the language that people use, it doesn't make it very clear. It's really quite murky sometimes.
Well, I think I agree with what you say, but I also think there are a lot of people out there who say, well, I've tried the cookies and I've tried the positive reinforcement trainers and my dog is still doing X, Y, or Z. And they are desperate. You know, the human-animal bond has fractured or is about to. When that happens, the dog actually lands in a shelter. So I understand the desperation of people. Do you follow what I'm sort of asking here? When people are that desperate, but they don't understand that desperation, I understand it, but going to that type of trainer, well, it's hard to believe, but actually make matters worse, at least in the long run.
Yeah, and I think in the past, people used to sometimes think that maybe aversive methods might be appropriate, like as a last resort. And these days we know there's no evidence of that. That's actually included in some of the position statements from organizations about using reward-based methods. And unfortunately, they can risk making things worse. So there is evidence that they can risk making fear, anxiety, and aggression worse, for example. But really, if someone is struggling with their dog's behavior, if you're struggling with that, it's a good idea to seek advice sooner rather than later. And I think often people, especially with fear, they will wait and they will hope that it will go away. And that's a completely understandable hope. But really, it's much better if you do something about it sooner, and that can help. And if you're really struggling, you should also be talking to your veterinarian and seeing what your veterinarian can do to help. And these days, most dog trainers have a good relationship with their local vets, and they know when to refer people to their vet. And it's really important to know that they're, you know, we're both part of the same team. We're all on the dog side.
Absolutely true. And I'm on your side. This is a great book. It's called Bark, The Science of Helping Your Anxious, Fearful, or Reactive Dog. And I want to read the subtitle again, The Science, because it is based on science of helping. And it does provide useful tips that will help your anxious, fearful, or reactive dog. Zazie Tide, thank you so much. This is kind of interesting. It turns out most people in America have a pet. That we know. But most people then who have a pet travel with their pet. According to Global Pet Link and a new survey, 78% of American pet owners travel with their pet or pets at some point during the year. About 54% of cat and dog owners are planning to include their furry companions in an upcoming trip. As for travel preferences, 64% of pet owners opt for car travel. 33%, that's a lot of pet owners. I mean, think about it. How many pets are there? And that's a lot of pets. Millions and millions will fly by airplane. 52% of pet parents say they're sad while they pack their bags. Their pets are sad when they pack their bags, and as a result, they are feeling guilty about going on vacation without their pet. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.